Aloha, everyone, and welcome to Making Love Visible. My name is June Dillinger, and I am your host. I'm your hostess. I'm your podcaster for the day, and I'm delighted that either you are listening or you're looking with your eyes for the vlog or the podcast. I have an amazing guest that I am really excited to introduce you to. Her name is Gigi Kennedy. And when I say Gigi, I mean like the letter G and the letter G. Those are two capitals, Gigi Kennedy. And I met her in Dallas about 5 years ago, and she just exuded this foundational, quiet confidence. And she popped up on my screen recently in my awareness, and we've had the opportunity to work together, and she's just a pleasure. And something she said to me recently was this. She said, "I belong to five Black elite social clubs." And she served at the executive level on two of them. And now what I'd like to let you know is that today's title of this episode is called Being Black. Let me welcome Gigi Kennedy. Yay, Gigi, welcome.
Thank you so much, June.
I'm not even sure where to begin, but I do know that when you told me that you belong to five Black elite groups, I said to myself, I need to know more about this woman. Could you just share a little bit of your background and how this came to be? Because this is going to be a very interesting topic for me, clearly, because my spirit lives in some white skin and your spirit lives in some brown skin or Black skin. So tell me a little bit about you. Let's share with our audience.
Okay, well, thank you. The first thing I'd like people to know is that Black organizations were founded and chartered because there were white organizations that would not let Blacks be a part of them. You know, Jim Crow and, you know, just generally over, you know, throughout history, that's the way things have been. And so we always had sort of shadow types of organizations, but those organizations are more lifelong things because of the role that they play. You know, and so, for example, when I went to, graduated from Northwestern University, and the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority appealed to me because my mom had been one and my aunt and, you know, that sort of thing. Well, mm-hmm. You know, we were 18 years old, and I am a member still today, you know, five decades later. And it's because the service and sisterhood and all of those things helped to keep me strong, helped to keep me, you know, stable, you know, helped to make me feel loved and wanted in an organization. And so later on, I joined another one, my mom's organization, and it's all about friendship and activity. And so I've stayed in that one for 35 or almost 40 years. And then others came along because people knew me and they thought that I'd be fun to have in the group. And then the fifth one actually is an auxiliary group for my husband's fraternity, which is Kappa Alpha Psi. And they are the only fraternity that officially has an auxiliary group where they have wives, you know, widows, they have, you know, all the women, and we help them to do all of their service stuff. And so I served at the executive level at that organization as well. A lot of activity, but I always worked in areas where I had head work. And this provided an opportunity for me to do heart work.
I see.
So I was sort of separated in that way, you know, compartmentalized those things. And that's why those organizations have always had such an importance to me.
That makes complete sense because I know you have a Bachelor of Economics from Purdue. It's a master's, an MBA, I guess is the mm-hmm. proper term. And to me, that's all head work. And so mm-hmm. I can see why heart work would make an a huge difference. And as I'm listening to you, I'm noticing this bubbling up of ignorance and on so many levels, it's almost frightening. I could almost bring myself to tears because I remember on several of the conversations that we've had in the more recent past, when you referred to we, it was as if the we was not including me because I don't have brown skin. And I get it. But at the same time, I thought to myself, what kind of boundaries or what kind of barriers are your clubs able to break through and the kinds of conversations that you have? Because as an executive of these social clubs, which are so vital to our existence, what kind of conversations show up around blending, if you will, or bringing separatism into a sense of oneness? Is that a logical question?
That's a very logical question. And, you know, I touched on this a little bit, and that is that the purpose of these organizations and the reason why they exist is pretty much separatism. I mean, you will find whites in some of these groups. It's very rare, but it's a place where we can feel safe among ourselves. It's almost sacred space. Now, from the time we're born, we hear the word give back. And, you know, that becomes, you know, a mantra for, you know, and I don't like to speak for the whole race, but, you know, for all the people I know, we want to give back to Blacks because so much has been taken away from us over the years and throughout history. For 400 years, it's just take this, take that, take this, take that. And so what we're trying to do is to, you know, just hold the race together and instill pride and help people to not feel othered outside of, like they do outside of the Black race. Now, as far as you're having felt a little othered, it's interesting because I was actually in a meeting. I'm earning a badge at work. They do these things where you can earn stuff. And mine is inclusion. Mm. So I spoke and you know, everybody was sort of like, ooh, yay, about inclusiveness and how we all have to work at getting outside of our bubble and learning all the ways to play as far as inclusion. So I know from my standpoint how I feel about inclusion. It's primarily being Black and being a woman. But there are also, you know, things that I am not as attuned to, but I am working very hard to understand. For example, the LGBT community. I am in an affinity group at work that helps, you know, just has organizational, you know, trainings and other things for us to become allies and for the LGBT workers and employees to get comfortable and have a safe place, a safe space. You know, another one is the Asian community. I was born in Japan and was raised my first 4 years by a Japanese woman because my mother was out integrating the Department of Defense school. She was the first Black teacher out there. Then we lived in the Philippines when I was a little older. And, you know, one of the things that my parents always did when we lived in different countries and different areas was they acclimated to the area. So we're in the Philippines, you know, going to Baguio, we're going to, you know, Subic Bay and, you know, riding horses in Baguio on the beach and, you know, doing all kinds of things, going to the barrios, you know, where they would touch our hair and touch our skin. Because they had never seen, you know, and it was more being American than it was being a Black American. But, you know, we were Americans. They touched our car and they touched, you know, and so, you know, we are, have very much assimilated wherever we went. And so I wanted to you know, what I want to do is to make sure that I keep that and really try to recall that Asian-ness that I experienced, because I think it's very important, especially today, given what's going on with Asians, not to mention that my husband is 1/8 Chinese.
And I was married to a Chinese man for 20 years and my son is half Chinese. Yeah. May I share a thought?
Sure. Absolutely.
So there's a word that comes to mind and it's sacred. Mm-hmm. Sacred, sacred, sacred. And I've jotted down a couple of notes because the first thought that popped up for me was when you said a group, and forgive me if I don't get it exact, but it was a group where it was just you folks and not outside sources. It reminds me of when I was in college, I had a psychology class and they told me to go to an AA meeting. Well, I showed up at an AA meeting that was a closed meeting and they were not happy. They were pretty, I didn't know the protocol. I didn't know what I was doing. And part of me sort of makes me wonder, maybe that's why I'm not a drinker to such an extent. I'd be afraid. But the other half of that is that I became a grateful member of Al-Anon later on. And then to play off of that, I was in the clubhouse room yesterday called Hawaii. It was a Hawaii group. And they were talking about Ho'oponopono and the word aloha. And mm-hmm. I'm taking this out a long way as I understand this. But the idea was that there's a certain culture, there's an aspect, there's a respect, there's a sacredness to a group and an ethnic background and a race that becomes vital to existence. And when it gets muddied or salts, there's another word I'm trying to think of, I don't know where it went, but when it becomes polluted, then those pieces get stretched and the existence of what is no longer sacred. It's all spread out. And I appreciate the privacy. And so this, I just want to share one more piece. I ended up in a clubhouse group. I was quite intrigued and you might enjoy this. It was all Black women. They were all Baptist ministers from the South, or basically. And I couldn't see any of them, but I could definitely hear them because I did not sound the same. And they were saying, Lord of this and Lord of that. And I'm going to read from the book of Isaiah. And it was so sweet. And then the minute I came on, of course, I sound very different. And I said, you know, I'm Caucasian. I'm a licensed Unity teacher in Honolulu. They all turned on their microphones and are like, child, I'm your new best friend. And and all of a sudden I had all these new friends that I had created because I lived in Hawaii and because I was willing to step in. But I also sat back long enough to monitor, could I fit in? Do I have something worth saying? Could I be a part of this group? Could I be aloha? Could I come in without them even knowing, except that my picture is a Caucasian woman with bright red glasses and super white hair? So I think that monitoring of self involving environments that one is not aware or comfortable of is vital, because I wouldn't go to India and act like I knew what I was doing. I wouldn't go to Poland and act like I knew what I was doing. So I think that come from is really important. And so I'm wondering in your, from your perspective, how that lands for you.
Well, I have always been one to look before I leap. Okay. I believe that, you know, and that's come from having lived in 17 cities. You know, you sort of, you know, my father told me once, when I was a little girl, we were talking about moving around and he said, when you go to a city, observe and find out what everybody else loves to do in that city. And you start doing the same thing. And you will find yourself, you'll find that you're very happy. And so that sort of taught me to observe, you know, sort of kick back just like you did and figure out, you know, is this someplace where I really want to be? And, you know, it strikes me that with the Baptist, Black Baptist women ministers, well, you're a minister as well, you know, and that is, you know, that's intersectionality. You know, that's a place where, you know, they could understand, oh, okay, well, you know, she's one of us. Absolutely. You know, it oftentimes it doesn't really matter. Race doesn't matter as far as reaching out and being a part of things. I think traditionally we feel, well, actually, you know, there's an Asian woman who is very high up in the Kappa Alpha Psi Silhouettes, which is the auxiliary group, you know, and she says she gets looked at a lot and people kind of discount her a lot, but she is gung-ho in there, you know. And in my husband's fraternity here in Dallas, suburban Dallas, there's a white guy who pledged. And aside from being, you know, just physically awesome, and a DJ, he commands attention. And, you know, he is phenomenal, you know, married to a Black woman and everything. But, you know, race doesn't have to matter. You know, it's really attitude. It's really your personhood, your persona, and what you have to give and what your gift is that intersects with the gifts of all the others in the organization.
I definitely agree with that. I was adopted at birth, and my father was a paraplegic. He was paralyzed from the breast line down after an automobile accident while he was going to medical school at Yale. And so I grew up sitting on his lap board. And I often think that I like to believe that my broad-mindedness came from being raised in such a way that we were out doing our lives. And people would look at us like he was a hunchback or what was his problem? Because back in the 60s and 70s, people just were really not out in their wheelchairs, rolling around in life, going to fairs and doing stuff, driving. He drove a car. And I guess I want everybody. My friends are like, Junie, are you going to invite one more person? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to invite one more person. And I've really had to halt myself from not making big events, but to really being with just one person at a time so I can honor that person. But also get to know myself as a reflection of what am I busy creating here and why do I want to know them? And so in getting to know you over the last several months, it's been such a delight. The separatism, it just doesn't feel that way. And I don't want it to ever feel that way ever with anybody. But there's something also called fear. And mm-hmm. Fear has a way of getting in the way for multitudes of reasons. And so I'm wondering, over the years, how have you dealt with fear in being Black as the color of your skin, but the beingness of who you are is just who you are. So how has fear shown up for you?
Well, it occurs to me as you ask that question that fear as a result of being Black is no different from other fear. And I'm going to give you an example. When I was working in brand management at Kraft, I was kind of afraid to speak, but that wasn't because I was a Black woman. It was because, you know, I was young and new and, you know, and I just was sort of taking it all in before I would be able to speak intelligently, because, you know, that's kind of the goal. And I remember speaking up one time when I'd first gotten there. And you know how you're around a conference table, everybody is in this big meeting and everything, and you know, the head guy, and at that time is always a guy.
Probably, was he white too?
Yeah, of course. And he, you know, asks a question and, you know, everybody's sort of, you know, just sitting back. Well, I very meekly answered the question with a little funny little pun. And he said, that was good. That was good. Who said that? Who said that? You know, and everyone said, oh, it's her. And he was sort of like, oh.
Yeah, you know. Interesting, yes.
So all of a sudden, the idea, the pun, the whole thing just kind of went flat. Because
it was so big, and then it got that got
I wasn't one of his people. And so that was a lesson learned that, you know, you just don't stop. Don't stop being who you are. You know, speak out, do what you're going to do. Other people are going to do what they're going to do. And, you know, so just keep going. It's really tough sometimes because, you know, as a lot of Blacks will tell you, you know, and especially before, you know, pre-COVID-19, when you're driving, when you're walking, when you're in the grocery store, when you're just about anywhere, there were certain what people call microaggressions. You know, I call them, you know, assaults. I don't believe
microaggression. Is that the
microaggressions? Yeah, that is
or assault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is sort of a way of saying that somebody did something to you that was race related.
I see.
You hear about, you know, Karens. You hear about, you know, walking while Black, riding your bicycle while Black, you know, playing with a toy gun while Black, and you know, these are very serious things because these all resulted in the deaths of innocent Black people, but. I don't have the fear anymore corporately, but I do every now and then, I have a bit of trepidation about going to the store. You know, now I hide behind my mask, but before then I would just avert my eyes from everybody because you know what? I just don't feel like dealing with it today. You know, I don't feel like dealing with your, you know, yanking your handbag away from me. You know, I don't feel like, you know, you breathing out on me because you don't want to breathe in when I walk by because you think I don't smell good. You know, there are things that I just don't want to deal with after work, you know, when I'm going to the grocery store. And so the fear has taken a turn over time and it is now, you know, I'm in control of this.
Right.
You know, and not only am I in control as to how I treat it, but also how I internalize it. And so it's fine now. I mean, there are still hurtful things that happen because people, you know, people are people, but the fear is gone. I don't have that fear.
That's beautiful. It reminds me when you say mask, there's, of course, in Hawaii, we have a huge Asian community and, customary is not to look somebody in their eyes. And now everybody's wearing a mask and you can't see their mouth. So you see these soft almond eyes and they sort of go up on the sides when they're smiling. And it's mm-hmm. such an interesting transition of seeing people differently. And I'm wondering for you as a Black woman, has the mask changed the culture of beingness in your skin at all? For an added level of safety, or I mean, now anybody can wear a mask into the bank. You know, anybody can wear. You have to wear. Well, in most states, at least, still in the United States, they're mask wearing people. So I'm just wondering, has the mask changed anything for you at all?
Well, you know, interestingly, it has not changed anything for me from a race standpoint. Working from home has, but not wearing the mask. I believe that the significance of the mask comes from where one is in their life. And again, another example, my husband is immune compromised. Okay, he has MS. And so we have fought like crazy during this time to ensure that COVID-19 does not come through this door and affect him because he can't fight it. And so the mask to me takes on a different meaning. I wear a KN95 mask, the same that the medical professionals wear. And it empowers me because it says, I am doing something for this person, my other half, this guy that I love so much that I've been married to for 35 years. I am doing something very concrete and specific to help him and to help him health-wise. And so I believe that anyone you ask that question of will probably have their own story and their own take on mask wearing and what it means. To me, it's not a race thing. It's really a health thing.
I do understand that, and I honor that answer. I've heard you share about Scott and his MS on several occasions.
And can I say it's also a love thing?
Yeah, it's a love thing.
It's
you
a love thing.
You are making love visible for him. I love that. I guess what I was thinking was that now that everybody, well, not everybody, but most people are wearing a mask, there's more opportunity to look in someone else's eyes. Mm-hmm. And I've always done that because I've always been curious about people. And I guess I've lost my point, but the idea was just around wearing a mask. And did you feel any more safe? Because it was sort of it's leveled out a playing field, so to speak, I would think. I don't know, maybe that's just something ignorant and it could be possible.
No, I think, you know, you raise a good point when you see, when you're especially someone who observes the eyes and the facial features, and you read that to better understand individuals. You know, I come at it from a more holistic standpoint where, you know, this pandemic has hit the world and we are all in this together. And
it doesn't matter what color your skin is.
Right, exactly. So, you know, COVID's the enemy now. which is great because, I mean, unfortunately, it takes an enemy to, you know, have people coalesce, you know, but I'm finding that there is a little more, niceness, a little more courtesy, you know, a little more of a positive feeling from people overall. Because, you know, we have this, you know, esprit de corps. We're gonna fight this. We're good. We're gonna do this.
On whatever level possible, that's for sure. So I am wondering if I have, this is such a short amount of time on this topic of being Black. How are you making love visible in being Black in your life today?
Well, family, friends, people with whom I am in organizations. No, I'm not doing anything really specific. I am just throwing the love out there, just all the time. And people respond very well to that. I'm also, but that said, I am very, very, very concerned about food insecurity, especially for Black folks. I'm worried about the lack of vaccinations because of availability, not because people are hesitant, but because of lack of availability. You know, you've got retail deserts in certain communities. There is no CVS, there is no Publix, there is no, you know, they would never find themselves opening a store in those areas. But those are the people who are supposed to be giving out the vaccines, you know, administering the vaccinations. You know, so what I'm doing behind the scenes is I'm working with some folks on at a specific food, and I'm looking to perhaps set up something else in another state that rivals that, because I know that these people need food. You know, college students don't have, you know, lots of food insecurity, and also health, and that to me that means getting fully vaccinated. And so I'm working with a couple different organizations to try to make this world a better place as far as, you know, feeding people and ensuring that we as a race live longer.
Oh, Gigi, thank you so much. Have I Is there anything else that you would like to share? Because I can only, there's zillions of things that I could have missed and probably just not time for, but what would you like to share as a closing piece today?
Well, what I want to share is that, you know, as one Black poet during the Harlem Renaissance said, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. And while I talk about, you know, riding horses on the beach in the Philippines, about, you know, many other types, you know, good things that have happened in my life, I could tell a story. I mean, there is a litany of things that have helped me to grow and to appreciate my Blackness, and have made me very wary of certain white institutions. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not one of those, you know, Black folks who has, you know, just kind of slid down a staircase and, you know, everything is cool. No, not at all. And I can tell you probably about 10 different stories. I'm going to tell you just one short one. And that is that my brother was called Baby Gorilla by all of the Black golfers. My father was a big, big golfer. He turned down a golf scholarship at a Black school because his father said, you're not going down there and get killed in Jim Crow. So he went to Ohio State. And my brother also went to Ohio State. But before that, we were in South Carolina and he tried out for the golf team at the school and did so well. And they said, there's no way that we can't let him on this golf team, but then there's no way that we can. And so because of the places where they had to play golf, they were totally segregated. And so do you know that school canceled its entire golf program for 4 years while my brother was in high school there? And the year after he left, they reinstated the golf program. You know, so what that says is that, you know, sometimes racism is so deep, it runs so deep that people would rather deprive themselves of things and hurt themselves and their own families and friends than to let a Black person do well and excel or exceed.
Oh my gosh.
So I just want to leave everyone with the fact that, you know, yes, I have had a great life, but it has not gone without, I have not gone without these microaggressions, these, you know, assaults, insults, you know, things that I can turn to in my life that really shaped me and really hurt me a lot. And so consequently, Scott and I are doing these anti-racism groups, and we do 4-week groups. And you can get in touch with June if you'd like to be a part of one of these groups. It's a safe place where we talk to primarily white people about anti-racism and answer all those questions that, you know, you're afraid to ask anybody about race. And they're 1.5-hour sessions once every four weeks. And they usually want to go longer. Come on, let's do another week. Let's do another week. Because we end up uncovering so much and unpacking so much for people. And so rather than to wallow in the hurt, you know, we are choosing to do something about it.
I love hearing that. I feel like you were just reading my mind because I was just getting ready to ask, where can we send listeners and viewers for information that will broaden themselves, their horizons, and the possibility for more kindness in the world? And the next thing I knew, you said. So what we'll do is for the audience, we'll just go ahead and hashtag that, and I'll make a note in both the blog and the podcast. Gigi, it has just been lovely having this conversation. This last part, all of a sudden, my mind was on fire with like 100 more questions, and there's just only so much time. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And in this vehicle that was named June, with this white skin, yellowish green eyes. Yeah, and I'm just so grateful to have the blessing of your friendship. And would you like to say aloha before I sign off, or chow chow?
I would like to say aloha, and I would like to tell everybody that June is one of the best people I have ever met in my entire life.
Stop. Got goosebumps, chicken skin, Gigi. Thank you. For all of you that are watching today, I'm so grateful for your time, for your willingness to listen to myself, June Dillinger, and our guest, Gigi Kennedy. It's just who doesn't want to learn? Well, I don't know. I wanted to learn more about being Black. And having somebody as graceful and as kind and with such a gentle delivery as Gigi, who has experience living in her own skin in being Black, was really valuable. And I think there's more to come. She and I might need to have a talk show together, I think. And so please tune in next week. We're going to have another special guest. And I want you to go out in the world and make some love visible yourself and see what you can create. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in and listening. And I look forward to seeing all of you and all of you listening next week. Aloha.